New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Hello, history lovers, and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Karyanis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio, and a special tip of the hat to everybody watching today's time travel adventure via our YouTube channel. I hope you'll subscribe there to get more of a classic history channel feel from these interviews. And also you can read my columns in the Washington Times to get my analysis of today's current events in light of yesterday's America. In this episode, our time machine welcomes back one of my all-time favorite people, never mind my favorite guests. He's Gerald Posner, and he brings us his landmark book, Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. Gerald first appeared on the History Author Show in 2015 to discuss his book, God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. And he also shared his eerily prescient book that hit the shelves on the eve of the pandemic. That was called Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. His wife and research partner, Tricia Posner, also shared her chilling biography, The Pharmacist of Auschwitz, The Untold Story. You can find all those interviews in our archives at historyauthor.com or wherever you're enjoying this conversation. Gerald Posner is a distinguished attorney, journalist, and he's the author of definitive books on everything from the Nazi Angel of Death, Joseph Mengele, the Oklahoma City bombing, and Motown, to Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. You've probably seen him on TV. He's been a fixture, and I could really just let him talk for this entire hour interview because he's that good at holding your interest. He's also a columnist at Forbes magazine. That's a new outlet for him, so please do go check him out. You can also visit him at posner.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram, where you can find me as well. Okay, now that we've arrived at Dealey Plaza, as the presidential motorcade rolls into view for its date with destiny, let's join Gerald Posner and declare the story of this dark chapter in American history, Case Closed. And we're joined now by Gerald Posner. He's author of Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. Welcome back to the History Author Show, Gerald.
Dean, great to be back with you. It's a treat.
Well, it's a treat just to get this book, never mind to be able to speak to you, which is always so enjoyable and enlightening. I really feel like I could just let you talk here. So I'll hit the questions and you make your case, because you do it in a way that nobody else I've ever heard do. And it's got a lot of authority and weight behind it, but I cannot imagine a more challenging and thankless job than digging into the truth of an assassination that so many people don't want to know the facts. They plug their ears and la, 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 like little children, and they don't want to hear at all what the truth is behind it. So what inspired you to wade into this sea of misinformation and rumor and anger in search of the facts so that you could tell this story completely and close the case?
Well, you know, you ask a great question. What attracted me to do the book in the first place was the idea of delving in to look at it as a lawyer and an investigative reporter. Just, I knew that one thing could not be true. Not all of the theories about who killed Kennedy could be right. It couldn't be the KGB and the CIA and the Cubans. It couldn't be the mafia. Some of them had to be wrong. Couldn't be a shooter at the grassy knoll or two shooters behind or however it was. And I was in law school when the House Select Committee in the late 70s reinvestigated the case and then had reached a conclusion that there was a 95% chance of a conspiracy. So I was always following it. I was interested in it. I wasn't an assassination buff in that sense, but it had been something in the back of my mind that I'd like to look at. And I finally went to Random House without the idea. I didn't think it was possible. I mean, I didn't have the hubris or the craziness to think you could close the case, reach a conclusion. I never went to a publisher and said, by the way, I think I can write the book that solves the Kennedy assassination. I said to them, what I'd like to do is go in, examine all of the evidence, debunk the things that are clearly wrong. There has to be a lot of wrong things in there, and then settle on maybe the four or five issues that we can't resolve and say, okay, this is a primer on the JFK assassination. Read this book before you read anything else, and you'll at least know what the real issues are that are still outstanding that need to be resolved. And Random House said, we don't like that idea very much. We don't think anybody will be interested in that. And I went off and did a book instead called Hitler's Children, about sons and daughters of Nazi war criminals. And then Oliver Stone did the only good thing he's ever done for me in his life. He did the film JFK, which is, you know, great film, terrible history, but it re-energized the Kennedy assassination for the public and also re-energized it for publishers. And the publisher said to me, you know what, maybe somebody will be interested in a small book that says, here are the remaining issues. And I went off and did that. And it wasn't about until halfway through my research that I started to believe that there was an answer to the case and that it might be as unsensational as Oswald alone. And when I had a meeting with my editor and the head of Random House, Harry Evans, who was the former editor of the London Times, and it's been set up the investigative team there. He was a believer that the mob had killed Kennedy. And when I sat down and told them, you know, I don't think you need to put out a book that says, here are the four or five issues left in the case. You can put out a book that says, here's who killed Kennedy. And they said, who? It was my editor, Bob Loomis, and Harry Evans. And I said, Oswald. And Harry said, and who? I said, Oswald. And there was a moment at which you could tell they looked at each other as though I'd lost my mind. They thought I had gone off and read the Warren Commission and nothing else. And then when they heard what was new and different, they really got behind that book, and they made that book into a book that caught attention when it was published in 93 on the 30th anniversary of the case.
You mentioned Hollywood and Oliver Stone and that infamous bit of terrible history. And that reminded me of another man in Hollywood, journeyman producer Donald P. Belisario, because he has a fascinating distinction in that he was a Marine sharpshooter in the same outfit as Oswald. And he has some great observations. He says he's watching it. His son is convinced. He sees the Oliver Stone movie and thinks, oh, well, it was a conspiracy. Here it is. It's all right on the screen. And all of his PAs at the time on Quantum Leap, which was his show that he was producing, all thought they bought it. Hook, line, and sinker, I believe is his phrase. And he says, no way. Oswald, quote, could easily have racked off three rounds well within the time limit. And he was somebody who I wasn't surprised that he did. He sees him on the TV screen and says, I know that guy. And then when they say he was a former Marine, he remembers what Oswald was like. And in Case Closed, you introduce us to him. You say there were these two psychological evaluations, which is something rare to have of an assassin, of somebody who does something like this in that time period, specifically about the mechanics of the shooting. What will people learn from Case Closed about that aspect of Oswald and how what Mr. Belisario observed really was true? This was not an impossible shot to make.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are certain what I call the fixed in concrete falsehoods or canards about the assassination. They've been repeated so many times that people believe them to be true. And one of those that people believe to be true without doing any research at all is that nobody could have pulled off the shots that Oswald made that day, that even a world-class assassin couldn't have fired three shots from behind the president as fast as he did and as accurately as he did, and especially Oswald with a $12 rifle and not being a very good shot in the Marines. It turns out all of that is wrong. That $12 rifle is a military rifle from World War II that fires a fully metal jacketed bullet that is very good at killing people at 2,000 feet a second, 160 grain bullet. Oswald, in fact, was a marksman and a sharpshooter in the Marines and knew very well how to hit a target 200 yards out that was 10 inches big 8 times out of 10. The shots were not nearly as difficult as the Warren Commission mistakenly believed and led people to believe for decades, because they thought the first shot had hit the president, and the second shot missed. That gave Oswald only 5.5 seconds, still doable, but a much tighter time sequence. One of the things I discovered in Case Closed and has since been proven time and again is he had anywhere from 8.5 to 10.5 seconds, a much longer period, almost double, because it's the first shot that misses. And we're now have pretty conclusive evidence of that off of the Zapruder film, the home movie of the assassination. So when you get down to the brass tacks, the question I always ask is, take Oswald out of the equation for a moment. Just ask the question as a researcher or investigator or a reader or somebody interested in history, is where do the shots come from that day? So when you examine the credible evidence, which in this case happens to be the x-rays and the autopsy photos, the only evidence that the president was hit from any direction was hit from behind. That's where the bullet struck him. So you know the assassin, whoever the assassin is shooting from behind. Now the question is what direction, what area? And there are studies that show that because of the way the president's hit, it has to be in the general vicinity of the Texas School Book Depository, where the building where Oswald was working that day and was left on the sixth floor of the depository by his co-workers. Now the question is, could one shooter, put Oswald aside, have made those shots in the time that they were made that day? And that easily is the case. We could talk about the single bullet, the so-called magic bullet later. And then the question is, if an assassin firing from behind at the presidential motorcade was the only one who hit the president that day, was it Oswald? I believe the credible evidence is overwhelming that it was. And then the tougher question after that is, if it was Oswald, was he doing it for himself or for part of a conspiracy? So people assume that if you answer one question about the case, like the single bullet, if you think that the single bullet really happened, as I do, that therefore you're saying there's no conspiracy. No, that's just one aspect of answering what happened at Dealey Plaza. Coming to an answer of what happened in the assassination is much more complex than that. Many people get stuck in Dealey Plaza. They get stuck in the ballistics. They get stuck in what happened at that assassination site. But even if I come out of Dealey Plaza absolutely convincing evidence that it was a single assassin, it was Oswald, you still have to ask the questions about, was there a conspiracy and what happened with Jack Ruby 2 days later when he kills Oswald? So it's a complicated case. There's no doubt about that.
So many places where things can go off the rails when people are looking at it. And if you're trying to find a conspiracy, if you're of that mind, then you will certainly find it in all these stories. But some of them are just so out there, and it's one of those topics where people feel empowered. Anything that pops into their head is somehow absolutely true. In a way, it presages a lot of social media, really, where any opinion that you have is just equally valid. And you come at this and do so, as you said, as a journalist and as a lawyer. You go and visit these places like the Texas School Book Depository. And I had a friend who's a TV journalist, and he said, I'd heard all my life that, oh, he couldn't have made that shot from there. He couldn't have done it in that time. He said, and then I went and I looked out the window and I said, oh, of course he could have. And my friend shoots a little bit, but he's no marksman himself. But you hear so many things over the years that are just outlandish that we absorb. And you go at them every single day. I see on Twitter, if you link me or tag me on Twitter, people get angry. So I wondered, having written Case Closed, are there any of these outlandish conspiracy theories or even small facts like the magic bullet that people cling to that really bother you, that really gets under your skin, that you just wish you could kill it once and for all, but it's impervious to facts?
Yeah, I mean, the single bullet seems to be one of those matters that almost is impervious to facts. I mean, Oliver Stone did a masterful job of portraying it in the most comical way, you know, with Kevin Costner playing the disgraced former district attorney from New Orleans, Jim Garrison, and talking about the bullet going through Kennedy and doing a left turn, pausing in the air for a few seconds, deciding where it was going to go, then going on into Connolly as though it was a joke of a bullet. In fact, we now know exactly how that bullet happened. Ballistics experts can recreate it all day long. The Warren Commission didn't have the technology nor the FBI in 1964 to understand how the bullet slowed up as it went through the two bodies and how it could come out just flattened as opposed to completely demolished after hitting those two men. But I think that if there's one particular aspect that people cling on to which there's no evidence at all, it's just the opposite, is the Grassy Knoll shooter. The idea that the world-class assassin was on the grassy knoll, because obviously they couldn't trust Oswald, they meaning the conspirators. Oswald couldn't pull off the assassination himself, so somehow he was duped into bringing his own rifle into the depository that day. He was duped to going up to the sixth floor and trying to shoot at the president, but the conspirators knew that Oswald wasn't to be trusted, so they put the world-class sniper on the grassy knoll. That's the sniper who took the president out. Now, question is, okay, fine, great theory, sounds good in a book. What's the evidence for it? And when you actually look at what I call, this is the lawyer and investigative reporter in me, I say, what's the best evidence? The best evidence of where the president's hit are the x-rays and the autopsy photos. There are some people who say those are faked. So I say, okay, prove it. What's the evidence of that? There is no proof. As a matter of fact, the authenticity of those, the x-rays and the autopsy photos were looked at in depth by the Assassination Review Committee in the late 70s, and they said they're absolutely authentic and they haven't been altered. The only bullets that hit the president that day came from the rear. So the world-class assassin, Dean, who's supposedly on the grassy knoll, who has the easy shot, he or she misses the president entirely, misses Mrs. Kennedy, misses the governor and Mrs. Connolly, misses the Secret Service agents in the limousine, misses all the people on the other side of the street who are standing and watching the motorcade go by. The real magic bullet in Dealey Plaza that day is from the grassy knoll shooter that doesn't hit anyone. So it's one of those things that on its surface just doesn't pass the common sense test, yet it continues to have a life of its own, and I marvel at that.
And I marvel at the fact that you're willing to go and confront these falsehoods. And not everybody is of ill will. Not everybody is a crazy tinfoil hat wearing person. Some people just don't know. I had a teacher in high school, and I've often thought back to this. I'm in 10th grade, and he said in those tones people use, some people, the mysterious some people say that Johnson knew the old presidential oath of office really well. He seemed to have it memorized on the plane. Even though I was a history mind then, I remember thinking, well, that sounds reasonable. I only when I got older and looked back and I said, wait a minute, not only does the judge read it to you and you read it back, but LBJ had been around forever. It's the same oath he'd just taken as vice president. He's in the Senate. It just doesn't make any sense, but you can make anything sound really mysterious when you say it in that tone and when you suggest it. And that's what bugs me. And I look at you as kind of like Clint Eastwood's character in The Line of Fire. And in that movie, he says, I've had to listen to these idiots on bar stools with all their pet theories forever. Is it just because they really don't want it to have been just a tragic, ridiculous thing that this guy fell through the cracks and killed a beloved president? Is that really the reason why? Why do people cling to falsehoods when really it denies him his rest and it denies Oswald his punishment by just letting him off the hook as this guy was just a patsy? He wasn't the real killer.
Yeah, no, Dean, I think you're absolutely right. It's very interesting how people almost have sometimes a need to make it bigger than just the idea that a just turned 24-year-old sociopath armed with a cheap rifle could end Camelot and change the course of American history. But we know from studying history that assassins have often done just that, whether it's the start of World War I or others. They often change the course of history just with a single shot. And William Manchester, the great writer and historian who did The Death of a President, summed it up very well. He said that, you know, if you look at something like World War II, on one hand, you have the Holocaust, 6 million dead Jewish victims and millions of others with gypsies and gays and Russians, all killed by the Nazis. Greatest crime and greatest criminals. They're almost stereotypical criminals. It balances a little bit. In the Kennedy assassination, on the one hand, you have this young charismatic president with so much potential for the future, the idea of Camelot, the best and the brightest, as David Halberstam later called them. And on the other side of the scale, you have this, you know, loser in life, Lee Harvey Oswald, who had never done anything right and suddenly manages to end it all and doesn't quite balance. It feels better if you can put something heavier on the Oswald side of the scale, if you can say that the CIA must have had to get together to kill Kennedy because he wanted to pull them out of Vietnam, or the CIA thought they were going to be disbanded, or the Russians wanted to kill Kennedy because he'd embarrassed Khrushchev at the Bay of Pigs, or Castro wanted to kill Kennedy because he knew that the Kennedys were trying to kill him, the mob killed Kennedy because Bobby was his brother as Attorney General was trying to break them up. then it means there was some meaning to his death. So I understand there's an inflexive sort of need for that. And it happens on 9/11. You know, the truthers say, oh, it can't just be a group of 19 hijackers getting three planes. It has to be the secret government or that. So we see it time and again. But in the Kennedy assassination, it's held on for a long time. And I think that, you know, you mentioned LBJ before. So very interesting. It happens in Texas. Of course, that's his home state. So it feeds the conspiracy theories about Johnson. Then people say to me, well, who had the most to gain? LBJ. And I said, well, of course, in any presidential assassination, the person who has the most to gain is the vice president. So if you want to think of it that way, presidential assassination means the vice president should be at the top of the suspect list. If you want to think of it in terms of who had the most to gain, you know, that I understand. And there's no doubt that in this case, what changes it as well for history is not just Oswald's unusual past, but that we never get to see a trial. We never get to see the evidence actually given in a trial. Jack Ruby robs us of that part of history 2 days later. So once he kills Oswald, you're guaranteed that you're off and running on conspiracy theories. And that's totally understandable. A blue ribbon panel, the Warren Commission, issuing a report a year later, that's not going to do enough to settle the issues without any doubt.
I feel like telling people, go back and look at some of the other assassinations that have happened in American history and even in world history. You look at the man who killed William McKinley, which is an assassination that I'm very interested in, a president anyway that I am. I don't like to distill their lives down to the assassination, which is exactly what we've done to John F. Kennedy. He's forever there, unfortunately, in that horrible still in the Zapruder film, getting his head shot. And so you look at them, they wanted to kill them too. You know, Czolgosz, it requires the president intervening and saying, don't let them hurt him and go easy on him because they're ready to rip him apart. And the assassin who shoots President James A. Garfield, he does it and says, Arthur is president now, the vice president. So imagine coming into office with that, right? Thanks a lot. Thanks so much. And don't stop helping. So all of these things have happened before. It's not unique to this. But afterwards, we get the idea of Camelot, and we feel, as you said, it has to have some meaning. And Jack Ruby robs us of that, and robs Oswald, too, in a weird way, of the notoriety he wanted, which we could certainly be happy about because we don't want the SOB to get anything good out of what he did, get the fame that he wants. In Case Closed, you demystify Jack Ruby's slaying of Oswald, which did exonerate him, really, to a lot of people. A lot of people think, oh, that little nobody couldn't have done it. He's innocent. He's the patsy, right? So how do you go about doing that? Because here you really have two assassinations in Case Closed that you have to intertwine and debunk all of the myths about them. So what about Jack Ruby?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting how you mentioned in the previous assassinations that sort of anger at the efforts to have killed the assassin. And one of the things, just before I get into Ruby's character, people forget this, that in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, when Oswald had been arrested a few hours after the murder of the president, in that weekend on Friday night, on Saturday and into Sunday morning, there was great grief for the president and tremendous public anger toward the person who had been arrested as the assassin. And when there was a crowd that had formed in Dallas, there's a local CBS news crew that is filming at the time outside the street. There was a crowd that had formed on Sunday morning because the police had announced they were going to transfer Oswald to custody over. They were transferring him from their police custody out to the sheriff and who would be the feds eventually. But the sheriff was going to take custody of that. And people were outside in the street waiting for the transfer to take place to see the car drive by that would have Oswald inside. When Ruby shot Oswald in the basement of the police headquarters and word spread out onto the street that Oswald had been shot, they didn't know he was dead. They said the assassin had been shot. They didn't know by who. The crowd breaks spontaneously into applause and cheers. It's one of those amazing scenes. We forget all these years later, that type of anger. You look at it today, it's a shocking event. You think, how terrible. How could anybody applaud the shooting of somebody else? But there was this moment at which the public was angry at the assassin. And Ruby thought that he would walk away from shooting Oswald, very much in a sort of an impetuous act by Ruby, but that's how he lived his life, sort of at the edge of the moment, deciding things without much thinking behind them and with his temper and hair trigger, what he was going to do. He thought he'd walk away from that as a hero. Oswald had killed the president of the United States. He had disgraced the city of Dallas, and Jack Ruby was going to deliver to him a form of street justice in which Ruby would get no time in jail and be hailed as a hero in many ways. And the unfortunate part of this is people will sometimes ask me, Dean, what's the key? What convinces you that it's Oswald alone and it's not a conspiracy? Is it the single bullet? Is it the shot sequences, whatever? And my answer is not a satisfying one to them if they haven't read the book or studied the subject, but it's Oswald alone, Oswald's life, and then Ruby. You need to understand those two men to understand what happened in Dallas that weekend. And they don't fit into an easy soundbite. So it's not something where you can go out and say, okay, here it is. 33 seconds, they did this, and then 2 seconds later, they did that, and that's the end of it, and it's perfect for the Today Show, and they can go on a morning show and explain it. You need to get a little bit deeper into understanding their personality, and then you understand what happened. And that's why many of the conspiracy books, many of the best-selling conspiracy books in the 1960s, from Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment to Epstein's Inquest to the series by Harold Weisberg, others, Oswald's a cipher. He's mentioned in footnotes. He's sort of a stick figure. And all they talk about is, you know, the conspiracies and what's happening with the CIA. You don't get any sense of Oswald. It's only when you really start to understand this very disoriented, out of control, young man who thought that assassination and political revolution was his, you know, ticket to history. And Jack Ruby's wannabe famous and delivering street justice, that you get an idea of the perfect storm that played out and met each other in Dallas that fateful weekend.
You did something small there, and you said, you talk about these people and their books, and there's 2,000 books or over 2,000 books here on this assassination. And part of the job you had in Case Closed is to challenge and debunk some of the things that these people have said and some of the things they've overlooked. What you say is as important as what you overlook. For instance, all of this evidence about Oswald and what he was like as a child and the letter that he writes and his marksmanship skill. And yet then you shifted to saying, once you understand, and I just want to point out to people, you, unlike the people that we're just talking about, unlike an Oliver Stone looking to sell movie tickets, unlike somebody looking to do the sensational book because it's going to get headlines, you didn't use that as an opportunity to plug your book. But I certainly will, because this is how you do understand this event. This is how you can talk to people. Sometimes people will confront you on it. What possible motive could you have? If people think, well, this Gerald Posner guy, you know, he's part of the conspiracy, which is what you think as soon as you question a conspiracy. I think you could be much better off if you just broke that story. you're a journalist. Look at your body of work. You're not a guy that just jumped out from under a rock. And that is amazing to me, that this book, and people can see it behind me if they're watching on YouTube, not tremendously thick. It's a really fast, interesting read. And it does so much heavy lifting. Those other 2,000 books for you, which is going to be my question, that must have been overwhelming research just in and of itself. Was that something that you said, gosh, a lot of it's repeated? Or did you just go about it from a fresh point of view and say, well, I didn't read this from anywhere else, and now I'm seeing all this information about Oswald and his childhood and his mother that was completely ignored in other books. So that helped you track and debunk some of these things in these other books?
What happened is I actually went about, so, you know, interesting, but it seems so old school. Trisha, who you've interviewed before, my wife, also an author, works with me. We made a handwritten card file index of the Warren Commission. There was no index to the Warren Commission. Now it's available online. You can do a search. You can find any document you're looking about. And that was torturous, going through all the documents. We bought the entire, you know, set we found in a used bookstore in San Francisco. So we had all the information that was there from those original interviews. And then we went about building the sort of what I call the biography of Oswald at the same time that we were marking up and looking through literally dozens and dozens of the leading books on the assassination, all of which were conspiracy books. And it was almost by subject, so that For instance, let's say that I came across, you'd mentioned very early on in the interview that Oswald's one of the few assassins in history in which we have these two psychological profiles of him, one by the Soviets when he tried to defect in 59, in which they thought he was crazy, but the much more important one in which he was a teenager at 13, he's just being a truant in New York's city schools, and he's picked up and he's sent to for psychological evaluation by a psychiatrist for a very minor charge of truancy. And the psychiatrist, this Renatus Hartogs, remembers him very well and has notes about him. Years later, it says to the Warren Commission, by the way, I remember him because he stood out because he was here on such a minor charge of truancy, not going to school. And he had these schizoid features with aggressive personality disorder and assaultive acting out possibilities. He had personality disorder, and I recommended that he get treatment from a psychiatrist, if not being looked at for commitment. And his mother took that advice and took him back to Texas. So we have a very rare psychological look at a future assassin at a young age. Now, what did the other books say about that? And I keep going through them and they say nothing about it. They don't mention it. It's not here. It's not even a footnote. So you start to build up, then you understand what's left out. And the reason this is so critical is I believe as a researcher, as a writer, that you need to look at all of the evidence, and it doesn't necessarily form a conclusion for you, but you can't ignore it. And this is what I mean by that. So, okay, I look at Oswald's life. He has a terrible childhood. He has a psychological report. He goes into the Marines thinking it's going to change his life. He follows his older brother, who was his hero. It turns out to be an unmitigated disaster. They think he's gay. They call him Mrs. Oswald. They call him, throw him into the shower. He hates it. He defects to the Soviet Union thinking he's going to be a hero. The Russians will say, oh, you're a former Marine. This is fantastic. Put him up on a pedestal. They tell him to leave the Soviet Union. They think something's wrong with him. He tries to kill himself. They move him to a provincial capital in Minsk. He marries this Russian girl. And after a while, he hates Russia as much as he hates the U.S., but he asks to come back here. It's the lesser of two evils. Goes through the long process, gets back into the United States where he's unhappy. And what does he do by the spring of 63? He commits himself to political assassination. But his target isn't the president. It's a retired army general, Edwin Walker. And Oswald's convinced he's going to be the next Hitler. He's a right-wing general running for the governorship of Texas. He tries to kill him. The bullet's deflected by the wood on a window pane, and he misses Walker by an inch, and he's frustrated by that. So he goes on then and moves to New Orleans, where Marina, his wife, makes a move because she's afraid he's going to try to kill Walker again. And he establishes now his next venture, which is, you know, a movement to get Cuba free. The real revolution is taking place. Free play for Cuba is going to help Castro in his revolution. And he stands on the sweltering corners of New Orleans for day after day, trying to get volunteers and people to sign up to his new organization. You know what he gets, Dean? No one. Another failed mention.
So he's the only one, by the way, not to interrupt you, but he's they make it sound like he was part of this group that was, you know, fair play for Cuba. He had a fax machine equivalent and some letterhead and got him printed up. And it was just no different than putting a Twitter account out.
And he's it. That's exactly right. And then he goes, he says, all right, I've had it. I'm leaving. I'm going down to Cuba. I'll join the revolution there. He goes to Mexico City 6 weeks before the assassination. And he goes to the Soviet and the Cuban missions and tries to get a visa to go to Cuba. And they reject him. And what's amazing is that when he comes back into the United States in early October of 63, he finds out the president's going to be visiting Dallas, but it doesn't matter. He gets a job at the depository, not through the CIA, but through a friend of his wife who knows somebody who's working there and calls up and asks for a job. And they put him there at the downtown location. They had another location outside of the city. They had more openings at the downtown location. And it turns out that the motorcade is set to go past that. And Oswald literally given the president on a silver platter. Here's a fellow who believes that his contribution to history will be killing Edwin Walker, a right-wing army general, and suddenly he gets the opportunity to kill the president of the United States. And the man that I came to understand in Lee Harvey Oswald could have been on the sixth floor of a building in downtown Moscow shooting at Nikita Khrushchev. He viewed both the Soviet system, the perversion of what he viewed as communism, and the American system as corrupt. He didn't like them, and he was willing to lash out at them in any way possible. He threw the biggest cog into the machinery. But here's what I mean when I say you can't ignore information. Although I see his troubled childhood and I see all of the problems that he had, there are other people who had equivalent terrible childhoods, who also had personality disorders, who might have gone in the Marines and been sharpshooters or marksmen, who had lives that were not stable, and they didn't go on to kill the president of the United States. all of that being said about Oswald's past helps explain why he ends up in the sniper's nest, but doesn't tell you that he's an assassin. You still need to independently check to see what happened on the day of the assassination. You still need to see whether he did it or somebody was helping him. So, you know, people avoid evidence or information about his past because they want to exonerate him. I include everything, but I don't use that as a false way of saying, see, look at what a troubled and terrible guy he was. Therefore, he must be the assassin. No, he has all of that background, but you have to look at the assassination independently to see whether, in fact, he was the assassin. And yes, he was. And then it fits together and it helps explain it. But, you know, people just think you reach a conclusion. You sit down on the outside and you say, you know what? I think Oswald did it. I'll write a book about it. There are people who come to conclusions before they do a book. And they go out and they find the evidence that fits their conclusion. The much harder thing to do is to go out and find and follow the evidence wherever it goes. And what you understand, because you talk to authors all the time, and I think a lot of lay people or readers don't understand, is that as a writer of a book, as an investigative reporter, you want to come back with the biggest possible story. You want to come back with a story that will open up eyes and people will say, what? I'm slack-jawed at that. The biggest story that I could have come back with would have been the absolutely credible evidence of a conspiracy in the murder to kill the president. At the time, it would have been convincing Peter Jennings, who was the host of ABC News, and Dan Rather on CBS, and Tom Brokaw on NBC, and the New York Times and the Washington Post, that I had uncovered the absolutely incontrovertible evidence of a conspiracy. I would have been Woodward and Bernstein in one, all rolled up at once. Would have been a much bigger story than the case closed, which concluded that it was Oswald alone. But I think in the end, you're obligated to follow the evidence and report what you find. Those are the facts.
Exactly what I was going to say. I'm enjoying this conversation so much. I hope everybody at home is. This is my conversation with Gerald Posner, and his book is Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. You can visit him at posner.com. From there, you can find all of his social media accounts for a steady stream of news and facts that cut through myths on a wide range of topics, such as pharma. That's the book right behind me. That was the last time that we had a conversation on the show. Really goes into it with exactly what you said. You want to go into it with, I want to find the facts. Let's see where they lead me. And that is just so important. We get so little of that these days. The Chicago Tribune wrote of this Pulitzer Prize finalist book, unlike many of the other 2,000 books that have been written about the Kennedy assassination, Posner's Case Closed is a resolutely sane piece of work, unquote. I love that word, sane. It jumped out at me because there is so much insanity out there. You approach this book from, as I was just saying, this point of view that I'm not going to have a conclusion and then hammer in the facts. One way that has been done in the Kennedy assassination is through the politics that you just mentioned, his politics personally, because here, Kennedy is a Democratic president. Here, Oswald goes and shoots this right-wing general, member of the John Birch Society, real an extreme guy, not a mainstream guy that today we tend to just call everybody right-wing or call them left-wing back then. I guess it's pretty balanced. The folks there at the Daily News, they ran that headline. It's one of the only places that I ever saw it was left-winger shoots the president. But people didn't want that. If you're a man on the left, you certainly don't want to be associated with this guy. You push him away, keep him at arm's length. And Johnson, certainly, he didn't want to be in the condition of old situation of old Chester A. Arthur. I don't want them to think he was one of my ideological compatriots. So they try to spin that. And I wonder how much of that spin in the politics of the moment to make sure that this assassin was not associated with left-wing politics, with the communist movement, how much of that impacted the conspiracy theories, where then people had a personal motive to say, this guy wasn't one of ours. It must have been somebody else. And then you pick whoever you want to blame.
Yeah, no, I think you raise an absolutely key theme. There's no doubt that because Oswald was so driven politically, and you know, people call him a hardcore left winger. And yes, he had been at one point, but I study his politics and his writings, and he thought he was smarter than he was. But he was sort of he had a left of center ideology that was also mixed with a bit of anarchism. So it was Oswald's own unusual make of politics. But there are two things that happened. In the immediate aftermath of the assassination, conservatives and those on the right sort of jumped at it and said, oh, This could be the Soviet Union behind it, or this could be Castro. He was killed by a communist. Look at that. Oswald had been in the Soviet Union. And the person who tamped that down more than anybody else behind the scenes was LBJ, because LBJ did not want to end up in World War III. He did not want to suddenly be dealing with the Cubans and the Soviet backers of the Soviet Union. He hoped the information would not come back that it was that. He didn't want a lot of speculation around that. What happens on the other side of the political equation is, you're absolutely right, that far left writers immediately come to Oswald's defense, because they said, it's too simple. You mean to tell us that a fellow who defected to the Soviet Union and is in the United States and then went down and tried to get to Cuba is allowed to come back here and kill the president? He must be a fake defector. There must be something else going on. So one of the very first books put out, as a matter of fact, was put out by a German leftist, a communist, Joachim Josten. Buchanan, an American communist, was one of the second to put out an early book. Harold Weisberg, who had been dismissed from his government job because of security concerns, and a hardcore leftist, went on to write a series of books called Whitewash. Mark Lane wanted to be Oswald's defense attorney until he got shot, and later represented Oswald's mother, represented a series of celebrated leftists over time, came out with a best-selling book called A Rush to Judgment. So there's no doubt that the first published authors who grabbed the public's attention were those who were left of center, far left of center, and came to Oswald's defense. They were giving Oswald the defense he never got in court. And over time, as the American public learned about the lies over, let's say, the war in Vietnam and the numbers of casualties, and then they learned about Watergate and then Iran-Contra and other scandals, they came to suspect in large part the government. So today, the biggest suspects in most Americans' minds are the CIA or the FBI or American institutions, you know, not Soviet or Cuban ones. So it's fascinating to watch it play out. But if you look at the way the conspiracy theory started, even Jim Garrison, the hero of Oliver Stone's film, the district attorney whose investigation I have a chapter on it, you know, that shows what a fraud it was, and books have been written on it by Fred Litwin and others since then that shows that Garrison knew it was a fake investigation and made up evidence as he went along. But the people went down there to help him, from Mortsall, Dick Gregory, to everybody else. They were leftist activists. They viewed this as an opportunity to get to the truth, and somehow the U.S. government must be behind it. It was always an effort to exonerate Oswald, not to look for the truth.
The truth is what you try to look for right here in this book, and get rid of some of those lines that have been sticking in our heads. You mentioned Dan Rather, for instance, earlier, and that's one of the things that he made his bones on. In fact, I guess he did it. That's when he started to first be a reporter, and he reports this unsubstantiated thing, this rumor that, oh, these children cheered when they told the kids that the president had been shot. And I think it was the president of the local affiliate at the time that said his kid went to that school. And I said and again, when you think about it, you realize it does not pass the smell test. That makes complete sense, right? You wouldn't tell a bunch of school children the president is dead over the PA system in any case, and children wouldn't cheer. But this is something that, this ad to this mystique rather was breaking a story, and it was making people feel like, aha, this is what the negative feelings were. Well, those negative feelings for every president everywhere. And fortunately, them being shot is very rare.
You're absolutely right. The two things. First of all, is an interesting footnote on Rather. When the book came out, Case Closed, Dan Rather was one of those who did an hour and a half documentary on it. We have a sequence that's up actually on my YouTube page. It's a 5 or 6 minute sequence with Dan Rather and looking at the Zapruder film in a digital format on the shooting sequence and what happened in terms of the headshot and the single bullet. Is rather remarkable. Rather was absolutely convinced, and he's a Texas reporter, you know, who came out of there, that it was Oswald alone. So, you know, no matter what his reporting was in the beginning, over time, as the lead anchor for CBS, he was convinced of that. And the people do forget that if a president is assassinated, unfortunately, there will always be some group that will, or some people that will celebrate that death. And if a president's assassinated, we may get the assassin at the scene, we may catch him at the scene. Oswald had to be caught away from the scene, but you're still going to be asking if that person killed the president for their own warped motivations or for somebody else. So if President Obama had been shot and killed, we'd be wondering is it anti-abortionist? Is it jihadist? Is it somebody who can't stand him? Is it a racist? If President Trump was killed, is it somebody who thinks he's a tyrant? Is it somebody who's against the government? There are all types of suspects along the way. There are groups. And this is something, Dean, I think that a lot of people don't understand right away. They hear my conclusion that I say Oswald alone killed the president, and they think, therefore, I believe that there were no conspiracies brewing against Jack Kennedy. Not at all. As a matter of fact, if you came to me tomorrow with tape recordings, let's say, of mob bosses sitting around a table saying, you know, that no good Bobby Kennedy and that no good brother of his, the president, we'd like to get rid of that SOB, wish you could find somebody to pop him off, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I'm sure there were discussions about people who did not like Jack Kennedy, who wanted him dead, just as there are discussions probably going on today about, or at any time, about an American president. There could have been conspiracies brewing against the president. What I conclude in the book is that whatever those conspiracies were, they had nothing to do with Oswald. He got there first. He beat all the conspirators, if there were any, to Kennedy. They would have pinned a medal on him, but he was not their boy. People assume that if you shoot the president, and another group wants the president dead, they must be working together. That's an assumption you can't make. You have to look at it, see the evidence. And in Oswald's case, he just was somebody. One of the reasons he was able to pull off the assassination is because he was on no one's radar, wasn't in a group that had been infiltrated by FBI agents, wasn't reported to the government in any other way. They should have known about him because he had defected to the Soviet Union. They did have an open FBI file about him. The CIA knew that he had tried to get to Cuba. There were a lot of red flags on him, but he wasn't the type of person who was in with a group talking about killing the president. It was a last minute decision, flew under the radar, and that's one of the reasons it worked for him.
You mentioned about these conspiracies against presidents that are always coming in. And there was a man who went with his car loaded with explosives, right, and parked outside the Kennedy house. And it's another weird parallel because Charlie Gateau, who shoots President James Garfield, sees him walking one day with his wife, and she's holding onto his arm, and he takes pity on them and says, well, I'm not going to shoot him now. Unfortunately, he goes and shoots him later. Very similar with this guy, goes there to kill Kennedy, sees Kennedy with his wife and kids, and doesn't decide to pull the metaphorical trigger and blow him up. Fascinating to me that nobody says, well, that guy was a conspiracy. Nah, that guy's not. He didn't do it. But it just proves, yes, there are lone, angry, hateful, violent people out there for Kennedy, just like every other president. And sometimes one of them sees, unfortunately, gets a target of opportunity, which is what is in this case. This sweet old lady hires him, basically your sweet lady, to work in the Texas School Book Depository. And as you said, he's served up to him on a silver platter.
One of the things, and you know this so well in looking at history, we will never know. It's speculative. We have no idea of how many times a person who was bent on assassinating a politician, whether a member of the House, a senator, or somebody running for president, or the president himself, has gone to a political rally in the past and then did not get the opportunity to try to take the shot and walked away from that event with the gun still in the breast pocket or, you know, in the back of the pant. We just don't know that, for instance. And sometimes assassinations need a bit of luck. Now, that may sound, you know, weird, but things have to break just right for the assassination to happen. When Brenner shoots George Wallace, for instance, he almost misses the opportunity to get to the front of the line where he gets a shot at Wallace. Wallace has passed by the area where Brenner is. If you look at the tape, then Wallace comes back to a woman who has a baby to sort of do what politicians do and gives Brenner the opportunity. With Bobby Kennedy in 68, when he's leaving the Ambassador Hotel, the original plan from his aides is to walk out the front of the hotel where there's going to be a press crew, and he's had the great victory. And Bobby's so tired that they make the decision shortly before he talks to the crowd. They'll go through the back area. That's through the kitchen. That's where Sirhan Sirhan is. If they went out the front, Sirhan would never have had the opportunity to have taken the shot in the first place. When Chapman shoots John Lennon, it's the night in which they come back to their house in Manhattan, their apartment building at the Dakota, and this time they slow at that part on the outside, giving Chapman the shot that normally isn't there. So for Oswald, he not only gets the opportunity to take the shots, if if Oswald's workers, his colleagues who were working with him at the school book depository, there were six of them on the floor with him before the president arrived. They went down a half an hour before to have lunch. They left him on his own. If they had stayed with him on the sixth floor, he wasn't going to pull out his rifle. This wasn't a suicide mission. He was somebody who would have taken that rifle home, and we would never would have heard of Oswald possibly. So we don't know how many times in history somebody can't be the that every assassin has always gotten off their shots, either successfully or not. With Reagan, as you know, one inch over and he might have been dead, as opposed to the shot that missed him. Assassinations need a bit of that last bit of fortuitous luck. And in Oswald's case, not only does he get the shots off, but on the final shot, on which he has a full 5 seconds to recock the gun, aim out through the 4-power scope. Kennedy at the farthest point looks 25 yards away from him. The car that Kennedy's in, open air, is being driven by the oldest member of the security detail that day, William Greer, 52 years old. He's made the mistake, unfortunately, of looking behind over his right shoulder to see what the commotion is in the back seat after the first two shots. He slows the limousine up, which is only going 10 miles an hour, to between 5 to 7 miles an hour. It's going in a direct straight line. The Kennedy wounded from the second shot is lolled over a little bit to the left. He's in a back brace so he doesn't fall over. Oswald gets the straight on shot. The car's making no maneuvers to get away, and he still almost misses. It hits the president in the high right rear portion of the skull. It's a fatal shot. It blows out the president's brain from the front, but an inch and a half higher, Oswald misses and the president lives. So we're literally talking about how close it is on these assassinations to being successful or unsuccessful, as was with Reagan, or not happening at all as it might have happened with others. And you think about it, we know Monday morning how it took place. So we think, oh, this is, you know, must have been planned that way. No, it falls into place either in the right way. It's even, you know, jumping up, you know, we talked before, mentioned 9/11. That morning when those planes took off, the hijackers had to hope that there was clear weather in all the cities. They had to hope there was no mechanical delay that kept one of them on the ground for an hour longer, that there wasn't a problem that kept them from all flying off at the same time. They did something that's unheard of in normal commercial travel. They took off on time from different cities. You know, you need a bit of, I know it sounds strange to say luck to do something terrible, but you do in some ways.
Yeah, and they have bad luck too, some assassins. You look at Giuseppe Zangara, who tries to shoot FDR and his chair breaks under him. What rotten luck is, because he's a little runt of a guy and he has to stand in the chair to see and he misses. And that's bad luck. The two women who try to shoot Gerald Ford, well, one of them, she didn't load the gun. She was trying to make a statement. But Squeaky Fromm, you know, if someone doesn't hit her hand, we're mourning Gerald Ford right now and talking about him. And probably that's part of the Warren Commission conspiracy at this moment, if God forbid Gerald Ford had been shot. Well, he knew the truth, and so they had to get rid of Jerry Ford. This is how these things feed off of absolute nothingness. The first presidential assassin that we know of that got very close was Richard Lawrence, tries to shoot Andrew Jackson. Both guns misfire. Oswald has a gun misfire there in the theater. So again, we're expected to just think somehow you can fictionalize it and make it a novel. And it's not, it's real life. That's just so important. You can imagine, that's fun, speculative fiction, but this is real. And you've mentioned those autopsy photos a few times. When I see those come up sometimes, I feel, this is a U.S. president, but also he has family. He has children. It's not fake. It's not an NCIS crime scene that's staged. That's not a mannequin. It's a human being and a U.S. president. So I love that Case Closed gets us deep into that. And then when something like, you mentioned the last two presidents, President Biden and President Trump, they both delayed the release of these government files, secret government files. It sounds so sinister, right? About the assassination. Right away, people say, aha. And I'm sure they say to you, how can you declare the case closed when that's got to be the smoking gun, whatever they have there? How do you do that? Because every time that comes up, I see you on Twitter, you get bombarded with, this is the secret, this is the secret, this is the secret.
I think governments tend to overclassify, use the confidential stamp too liberally, often on documents. And sometimes I know that from Freedom of Information requests, I will make a request for a document that really is not that important. And the bureaucrat who's making a decision on whether to release it or not has never really paid much attention to it. But the minute I ask for it, it now takes on an importance. and they're wondering why I want it. And they're holding on to it a bit more. And the Kennedy files are one of those cases in which, in part, the Warren Commission was paying tribute and listening to the Kennedy family, who did not want to make the death of a president into a public spectacle. Bobby Kennedy reinterred the president's brain at Arlington into a family crypt, because he did not want it to be part of a gruesome slideshow, Ripley's Believe It or Not, at some point. They didn't want to have the autopsy, x-rays and photos in the public domain. There were a lot of things about the sensitivity of the country, and Lyndon Johnson were very sensitive to Jackie Kennedy, and to Bobby Kennedy, who was still Attorney General at the time. So I think that that initial decision to hold on to documents, yes, it makes sense. But over time, I would have liked to have seen them release more. They did in response to the Stone film. That's another good thing that JFK did. It prompted Congress to pass the act in 92, a year later, to release the files. And the CIA says today, we're talking about 15,000 files that have a redaction in them. I mean, it's something, for those who don't deal with files all the time, redaction, something is blocked out. Sometimes it's as little as one word, and sometimes it can be entire paragraphs. Now, the CIA says we had assets, intelligence assets in Mexico City, because Mexico City was a virtual spies nest in the 60s. You had the Cuban mission, you had the Soviet mission, you had the Americans, everybody was spying on everybody else. So we had assets in the Mexican government or Mexican journalism that were providing information to us at the CIA in the 60s. They were in their 20s, these people. They're still alive in their 80s, all these years later. To disclose that they were assets for the CIA would turn their lives upside down. That might well still be true, but it can't be all 15,000 documents. So I hope that as President Trump had started, President Biden now has the ability to, they release as many files as possible. It will not settle the conspiracy debate. Those who believe in a conspiracy, if you release every last document and it doesn't provide a smoking gun about the conspiracy, will say, ah, see, I knew it. They destroyed the evidence. And I must say that as a journalist, if a conspiracy existed, and if the conspiracy that existed is the one that most people seem to embrace nowadays, that it was the secret government, the CIA and the FBI and others in our government who killed the president for their own motivation, do you really believe that they would have pulled off essentially the perfect murder in Dallas? They pinned it on Lee Harvey Oswald. Here we are over 60 years later. No one has found the real killer. But somehow, in the course of planning this perfect murder, somebody forgot to take out the document in the National Archives that proves that ordered the murder of the president. 60 years later, no one has gone over there to destroy it. They pulled off the perfect crime, but then they confess it all in a document that's going to be released as part of the archives. It's just not the way history takes place. So if you have an expectation that you're going to change your view on the case by the final release of these documents, I think your expectations are misplaced. And we will have more information about what happened in history, but we're not going to change, I think, the conclusions of what happened in the murder of the president.
I wanted to close by asking you to speak to both people who have their open minds, which seems like it's a very narrow group of people nowadays, dwindling as far as JFK assassination goes, but also those whose minds are slammed shut, the doors firmly closed. For example, the false view of Ty Cobb as a belligerent racist. I cite that so many times because Charles Learson did such a great job in his book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. There's plenty of great fiction out there. Go read that. But for this, I feel I want you to tell people why pick up Case Closed and really respect the death of the president. Don't let Oswald off the hook. Don't look for a conspiracy where none is there. If we can know facts, let's know them, because nobody wants to be walking around wrong. At least I don't, and I think most people are like me. So make your closing pitch. Why should skeptic and the person who's ignorant alike, doesn't know anything about the assassination, pick up Case Closed to enlighten themselves, to meet the real Lee Harvey Oswald that's overlooked completely his life in many books, and get the facts about the assassination, the assassin, and the assassin of the assassin?
You know, I think one of the things that I hear from some people that's most irritating is when they say, we'll never know. We just never know. That's not true. On any given area of history, as researchers and reporters, what our obligation is to look at the available and credible evidence and draw the conclusions about what likely happened. And the story of what happened that day in Dallas is it turns out to be a much more exciting story than you would think when you say a single assassin killed the president, because it's the story of a person, a biography of Oswald. And the most interesting feedback I get, yes, Dean, I get emails and things over the transom of people that say, you jerk, you idiot, you CIA tool, you're a fool, you know, who are you fooling? But I also get dozens of emails at different times, especially around anniversary time, from people who say, I've been a convinced conspiracy theorist for years. I was convinced, and somebody gave me your book, or I picked it up, and I wanted to hate it, and I read it, and now, and sometimes this is the one I smile at, they say, I wish I had read it earlier because I would have saved so much money on all those conspiracy books I bought. That's fantastic. That somebody who doesn't think they have an open mind goes into it, looks at it, it challenges them, and then they look at it in a different way. And so, you know, I think that I often, if nothing else, believe that when I hear back from readers who say to me, you know, I didn't think there was anything new, I'd heard the Warren Commission and that was the end of it, and then I learned so much that turned out to change my view of history, I think that's the challenge I have for anybody who wants to be informed. You think that you know history, and you don't until you actually get into the real facts. And I think that people who think there's a conspiracy, I'd like them to see how they feel at the end of case closed. If nothing else, they're going to have some real doubts about whether, in fact, on November 22nd, 1963, history wasn't changed by a guy called Lee Harvey Oswald with his own rifle.
Well, Gerald Posner, I wildly enjoyed speaking to you, as I always do. I so much enjoyed the book Case Closed. You summarized it perfectly there. You made your great pitch for the book. I really want to get back to reading it, flip through it some more, because it's that kind of book, and economical too. Why waste your money on those 2,000, any of them, other books that aren't going to tell you the real facts, that are going to skip over something as fundamentally important as Oswald's childhood? Think about how ridiculous that is. And once you meet him, you get to know him in this book, you see that's the guy. You see just what Donald P. Belisario said. Oh, yeah. Or my friend looking out the window of the Texas School Book Depository. Oh, yeah. He could have done that. He was the exact kind of guy that would have done that. Not this stuff that we hear. Oh, he was the nicest guy. I never thought he would do something like that. No, everybody thought this guy has a record. He has a record of doing things, not a police record necessarily. And that's the guy you meet here in Case Closed. And then you really can close the book, give the nation some closure. Thanks so much. Thank your wife, Tricia, for sharing you with me today for all of this time. I really appreciate your time. I hope everyone will check out your social media, check you out at Posner.com. Also, your informative columns at Forbes now, in Forbes magazine. All of your endeavors are just so great. Gives us hope for the future by the way you look into the past. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Dean, thank you so much. It's always great. And thank you, you know, on behalf of not just me, but all the authors that you cover and, you know, in such wonderful interviews, because I've discovered so many books that I've added to my to-read list as a result of your interviews, and I've thoroughly enjoyed them. And your interviews are often the ones that first bring them to light for me. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. It's high praise. I'm humbled by it. Again, the book is Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase your copy at the historyauthor.com page for this episode. By buying a book through us, you help keep the flux capacitor on our time machine humming like usual. My sincere thanks to Gerald Posner for joining us and for shedding light on the assassination of the 35th president. You could tell what I meant at the beginning of the interview, that I could just let him talk. He's so knowledgeable and he's so straightforward. He has no axe to grind in the stories he covers. He only wants to get to the facts. Please do visit him at Posner.com and also find him on social media at Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can find me there as well. And also please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, where I hope you'll enjoy future conversations about yesterday. That's it for this installment of the History Author Show. I hope you'll join us for our next all-new interview right here on iHeartRadio or wherever you're watching and listening right now. Until that next trip into the past together, thanks so much for time traveling with us today. And on behalf of Gerald Posner, Have a great week.
We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.